Two little men in a flying saucer flew down to Earth one day. Looked to left and right of it, couldn't stand the sight of it, and said, "Let's fly away." They took a look at a Western movie, somebody heard them say, "If a horse can be a star, think how dumb the people are."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm joined in the studio by Annie Jacobson, who is the author of a new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. She's an investigative journalist and contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times Magazine and the author of the widely read series, The Road to Area 51. Welcome to Background Briefing, Annie Jacobson.
Thank you for having me.
And this is a subject, of course, that normally is discussed in the wee hours of the morning on Art Bell, but you have you've actually nailed this. This is not speculation, navel gazing, and conspiracy. Let's start with how it happened. You had it at a Christmas party, right?
2007. I was seated next to a then 88-year-old physicist named Edward Lovick. He leaned over and he said, "Boy, have I got a story for you." And what he told me was that he was the lead physicist who had invented stealth technology for the CIA, going back to when Eisenhower was president. And lo and behold, it took place at Area 51.
And you had access to 74 people in total, scientists, pilots, and officers. And within that figure, I think it was what? Those are people that had actually worked there, but I think about 34 or 35 had actually lived there?
Yes, 32 lived and worked at the base for extended periods of time.
And the genesis of this, though, I think, as your book points out, is the Manhattan Project, in as much as it was in current dollars, it was a $28 billion project that was entirely secret. The president... when Harry Truman became president, only then did he know about it. And he had oversight prior to that in the Senate, didn't have a clue, and it's an extraordinary feat. And I take it the fact that they were able to build an enterprise on that scale and get away with it with utter secrecy, except for the Russians, of course, who knew all about it, has led to, that was the sort of, it proved a point. Whether, do you think that was the beginning of these black budgets?
Absolutely. That was the mother of all black operations. And that is the pole position on secret projects. And it sort of set a template for how secret a project can be. One of my favorite details about the Manhattan Project is that rural place in Tennessee where we were creating uranium and for weapons, there was that facility pulled more power off the electric grid than Manhattan on any given night, and yet no one knew it was there.
And there's also a kind of an analogy. So much is made today of Halliburton and, of course, the relationship that the former vice president had to it, the idea of a politically connected company. But the initial politically connected secret company, it seems to be the one that's throughout your book, Annie Jacobson, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base, is EG&G?
That's right. I think that it's the most important defense contractor at Area 51 that no one's ever heard of, or at least most people haven't heard of. And they had the contract to wire, fire, and arm all the nuclear weapons, beginning with the Nagasaki bomb. So they really had the in on the black projects, the world of black projects, and their role in all of that remains largely hidden today. I think I uncover some of it, but there's certainly so much more to learn about EG&G.
And the character that you portray in this, who was the man with enormous power, it was Vannevar Bush, who was also the founder of Raytheon. He was also the one that told Harry Truman about the bomb. Give us a sense of how and Howard Hughes, by the way, had a hangar there at Area 51. What is this interaction between powerful private individuals in the corporate world and how they can be segued into this secret world? And frankly, it's in the Constitution, I think, in Article 1, that the Congress has to publish a budget. And how did they get around the Constitution with these $20 billion black budgets, which are now probably half a trillion today? Who knows what it is?
Well, the atomic bomb, certainly the Manhattan Project set the stage for that. And absolutely the Constitution was not written for this idea of a parallel system of secret keeping, including the budget. But the Atomic Energy Act of 1946 allowed for that. And I begin the book by writing how I feel that that is a terrifying separate system of secret keeping. It's separate from the president's system. And when you consider, when you look at scholars who write about that system of secret keeping, they refer to it as the Atomic Energy Commission, now called DOE, having unanswerable authority. And that is absolutely the case. And Area 51 is a prime example of that, that private parties could have their thinking and research classified from its genesis infinitely.
So given that, well, let me ask you this. Did you find out more about Area 51 than Bill Clinton could when he was president?
Well, that is a very difficult conundrum, and I certainly write about that at the end of the book, because Clinton investigated, or asked rather, his blue ribbon panel of doctors and scientists and physicists to investigate the crimes of the AEC after a reporter named Eileen Welsom wrote about some of these horrific human experiments that were going on when she learned about it reporting for the Albuquerque Tribune. So Clinton put together this committee, and they produced a 900-page report on, you know, just abomination after abomination that the Atomic Energy Commission was able to keep secret because of their system of secret keeping. And one of the rogue programs that I write about at Area 51 is very disturbing. And when I asked the source, how come President Clinton didn't find out about this, or did he? The source's answer was he didn't have a need to know.
Again, I'm speaking with Annie Jacobson, who is the author of the new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. And let's talk about these human experiments, because years ago I was working with a great documentarian, Haskell Wexler. We interviewed some people who had been in those tests. You know, they put a lot of military people down there in the Nevada desert. And this fella told us that he was in signals, and he had to trace the wires back to these bunkers that were closer to the epicenter where the bomb was on the tower. And he noticed people that looked like they were either from an insane asylum or something like that, or from a prison, being led in. And then after it, he was so curious after the shot, he went back there and then he got, you know, shooed away. So it's always stuck in my mind. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just one person's anecdote. But I take it you've dug deeper here, and there's something systemic about the use of human experiments.
Certainly, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and the Clinton Committee learned that it went up to 1973, the Atomic Energy Commission has a history of doing experiments, using humans to conduct experiments, to push science, to see how far they can take things. And we learn about these things, unfortunately, only after the academics, for example, comes across something in an archive. Look, it just happened in October of last year. Hillary Clinton had to publicly apologize to Guatemala after it was revealed by an academic that we had pulled individuals out of mental institutions in Guatemala, we being U.S. scientists, to experiment with syphilis on them. And the idea that we did this is abhorrent, but the notion that we don't come clean with them until someone, provides academic proof is a pattern of the behavior of the Atomic Energy Commission and the government's approach to being transparent about that.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by Annie Jacobson, who's the author of the new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Now, of course, the book has gotten an enormous amount of attention, and a lot of it's to do with Roswell and this idea of the flying saucer and what was in it. And you've talked to these people who were there, and, well, first, let me just have you tell us the story. I mean, what is the story here? Because the notion that Stalin got hold of technology that the Germans developed towards the end of the war and was sending a signal by sending this craft over here, what was inside it, and what's the best knowledge that we have? Because clearly there's this persistent notion that this came from, these were extraterrestrials.
Well, let me back up for a moment about how I reported the book. As we discussed, I interviewed 74 people with this rare firsthand access, and everybody said to me throughout the course of my interviews, which took place over 2 years, you know, Annie, I will only discuss with you programs that have been declassified. And that's always a stipulation, because people who work formally for the government or as a contractor for the government, they sign exit agreements that they can't disclose projects that are still classified. And everyone would say to me, or not everyone, but a great majority of them would say to me at the end of my interview series and kind of jest, look, by the way, I'm only telling you 5% of what I know. So inherent to writing about Area 51 is this idea that whatever it is that you learn, you're only learning part of it. In the course of my interviews with one individual who was a contract employee of the Atomic Energy Commission, worked for EG&G, worked on nuclear weapons tests. That was his primary job. He revealed to me something that has not yet been declassified. And what he revealed to me has to do with the Roswell crash. And the reason I chose to report that in the book is because of my, what has now been 2 years worth of interviews with him. I found that every other fact that he gave me regarding his work with the Atomic Energy Commission across 3 decades on weapons to be absolutely fact-based. Everything checked out. I examined all of his records. I examined his accolades, his awards with the Atomic Energy Commission. He was a member of the Manhattan Project. He was in a position with his Q clearance, which is what an employee gets to handle nuclear secrets, top secret. He was out there in the desert. And when he revealed to me that he was an member of this elite team of five who reverse engineered this disc-shaped crash that had come from Russia, it was pretty surprising to even have access to this information. And I knew immediately, because of the way in which he explained it to me, that it was a matter of conscience to him and that there was much more to the story than just that craft. And so I worked with him for 2 years, largely talking about nuclear weapons for hours at a time, and then having access to this information in very small pieces. And what he did explain to me was that that craft had indeed been sent by Stalin. It was not Martian. It was Russian. And that what had been explained to him by Vannevar Bush was that the idea that Stalin had was to create a hoax a la the War of the Worlds, and that all the superpowers at the time were aware of this idea of black operations, of propaganda being used to create hysteria among the people. And some of the sourcing that I was also able to provide for that was the CIA's almost obsession with this idea in the early 1950s that the Soviets would perform a hoax involving UFOs and would overload America's early air warning defense system. So it's interesting how many people perceive this to be so far-fetched, and yet right there in the CIA documents, you see a concern over the Soviets' ability to use black propaganda to create hysteria in America.
So clearly there must have been some evidence on the craft to make it come from Russia, to for the conclusion that it came from Russia. And the obvious question was, how did it travel that far back in with 1940s technology?
And I asked the source that, and I'm very clear in my reporting that, you know, this is what the source told me. It was not the main focus of my book. I did not write a book to try to prove that this man was right or wrong. I spent 367 pages telling you about the history of Area 51, and in the last 7 pages I tell you, here's what I was told and why it would perhaps make sense why Area 51 is so secret to the point that the government will not admit it exists. And to that question, the answer that I was given by the engineer was that it came over from Alaska, and that discussion about how it got here was discussed among the engineers, but they had no firsthand knowledge of that.
So what was in it, though?
That is the real conundrum, is according to the source, inside were child-sized aviators who were not willing participants, and that they had been the results of these grotesque experiments by Joseph Mengele, the doctor from Auschwitz. And the source was so...
The Soviets had got they'd gotten Mengele's material, and then they had then experimented on and created these child-sized pilots?
Yes, and worked with their and furthered that program. And
were they alive when they got them?
They were alive. They were comatose but alive, according to the source, who received these child-sized aviators. Mm. And so his testimony to me involves his receiving the equipment and receiving the child-sized aviators. So that is not secondhand information to him. And
Because this is so extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, were they adult child-sized?
He does not know how old they were.
Right, but presumably you would reduce them down to that size because the craft is small, right? Is that the deal?
Well, I don't know. I can't imagine.
But they had big heads, right?
They had big heads, according to the source. They had big eyes. They were small. In my research, looking at the testimony of Mengele's victims, he spent a lot of time conducting these barbaric experiments on little people, for example. There's full documentation at Auschwitz about that. So, you know, people who are adults, but happen to be small. He experimented on hunchbacks. He was obsessed with people who had physical deformities. This is sick, wicked science, there's no doubt. And I made a decision to write about it in a manner that was brief but succinct.
Well, let's turn to the substance of the book, and there's so much to learn from your work, Annie Jacobson. Area 51, an uncensored history of America's top secret military base. First of all, it was a CIA operation from day one. Richard Bissell ran it, and they developed the U-2 spy plane there. He talked to the pilots of that, and they developed the Oxcart, it was called, which later became the SR-71. Interesting that I remember talking to some CIA or NRO people about that. The Air Force hates those programs. They hated the SR-71, and this is still today the most advanced aircraft in the world, still has broken all these records. And you report there also that the plane, or Oxcart, prevented a war with North Korea.
There's no doubt that many of the projects that took place at Area 51, a number of which I write about, absolutely kept America safe and out of thermonuclear war with the Russians. Meanwhile, on the other side of the fence at the test site, the Atomic Energy Commission and the Department of Defense were practicing how to have a nuclear war in the event it happened. So it's that odd paradox of espionage on one side of the fence, keep us out of war, and on the other hand, let's see if we have to have them, that we're game ready. And I find that infinitely interesting and conflicting at the same time. And that's very much what my book is about, that you can hold these two ideas at once. And to me, what the engineer told me at the end, and keep in mind that he spent his life in nuclear weapons, and yet the reason he revealed to me what he revealed was a matter of conscience. So the human element of things is a mirror to the political element of things.
And of course, nuclear engine that was supposed to be used in a spacecraft that was deliberately melted down and spread an enormous amount of plutonium. Oddly enough, I have actually seen that film by accident when I was working at Los Alamos. They gave me the classified film instead of something else I'd asked for, and it was cool. It was the Kiwi experiment, and I saw the whole thing happen. This whole meltdown.
Well, there's no doubt that the Atomic Energy Commission had authority that was unanswerable out there, and they did what they wanted to do, in essence. And, you know, a great theme of my book is that Lord Acton quote, you know, power corrupts, but absolute power corrupts absolutely. And there's no doubt that projects should happen in secret when national security is involved. But what happens if you get someone like a Vannevar Bush who is willing to push science at any cost?
Well, I suppose the only excuse is the time in which, you know, the U.S. was in because of its paranoia about the Russians, right? It's not an excuse, but there's a context there, right?
Yes, there's always a context. But if you look at, for example, Robert Oppenheimer, who opposed, and this is all taking place out there, who opposed the development of the thermonuclear bomb because the target was too small, essentially, for the bomb. The bomb was too big. And he was, you know, marginalized and sidelined and essentially experienced a downfall because he wasn't going along with pushing science to that extreme where you could end the world with a push of a button.
And, of course, one of the shots was much bigger than they thought, and it shut down Area 51, right?
And many of the nuclear weapons engineers that I worked on all of those tests. In the Nevada test site and out in the Pacific.
Well, let's face it, they almost let off 1,000 of them. What in God's name they were learning after, I mean, it became a kind of boondoggle, essentially. But that's the good news, that they don't do it anymore. I thank you so much for joining us, Annie Jacobson, and for your amazing piece of work here, this research that you've done. First time ever all of this story has been put together. Area 51, an uncensored history of America's top secret military base. And we barely scratched the surface here in the time that we had. What's your sequel, just in the last few seconds?
Right now I'm just keeping busy talking to people like you.
Well, but more of it's going to come out, isn't it?
There's that expression, more will be revealed. I really stick to that.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us. And I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. And this program's available at ianmasters.com for podcasts, where I also blog much less frequently than I should. And I'll be back again on Monday at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now.
This is Jamie Cromwell. You are listening to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.